Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Coming up, the 5,000-year-old murder victim found frozen on an Italian mountain.
The video game helping you to test your archaeology skills.
And we're in Northern Ireland celebrating the launch of the Festival of Archaeology.
It's all on this edition of the Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek. Here we are once again on YouTube, so you're able to see us as well as to hear us. We bring you the world of archaeology here on this podcast, and there's a lot going on at the moment actually in the world of archaeology because, as Derek and Lawrence have already said, the Festival of Archaeology is underway at the moment, taking place at loads of different venues right across the UK.
Yes, and speaking of which, Danny Wootton's going to be here later on in the podcast. She's been at one of those venues, Corfe Castle in Dorset, where Time Team's been helping to celebrate archaeology with demonstrations, talks, guided walks and much, much more. She'll have more about that and some archaeology stories in Time Team News.
Now, it's a good job we've had a bit of nice weather recently. It's been really hot, hasn't it, Helen? Very, very hot indeed. That is not the case for what we're about to talk about.
No, indeed it's not. Now, most people know about bog bodies, so remains that have been preserved in the oxygen-starved conditions of a bog. But there's another way a body can remain intact for long periods of time, and that's in a kind of deep freeze. Time Team's Giselle Kirai has been in Italy, finding out about a secret that stayed hidden for thousands of years.
I'm here in the Dolomites. This is a mountainous region in the northernmost part of Italy, and it's famous for one massive archaeological discovery, Uzi the Iceman. Now, two hikers were just going along one of these paths when they happened to find a body. And at first, people thought maybe this body is from World War I, maybe it's a more recent body. It was taken out, it was brought down to a museum, and it was found out that this body was actually 5,000 years old.
And this is what it looks like, being looked after round the clock by scientists at South Tyrol Museum of Archaeology. Uzi is a wet mummy, meaning he was fully preserved in a wet environment, so he is regularly sprayed with sterile water for his conservation. Archaeologists and scientists suit up 4 or 5 times a year, spray his entire body with sterile water in sterile conditions, then place him back in his fridge freezer. It replicates the conditions in which he was naturally preserved so that his body doesn't degrade further. Now, I wanted to find out a bit more about how Uzi got here, so back home, I sat down for a chat with Andrea Dalpra, a guide at the museum.
It was really, fortunately, discovered from a couple of German tourists. They decided to hike at 3,200 meters of altitude in the Similaun Glacier. They come across with the upper side of the Iceman's body coming out from the ice.
I mean, he was in the ice, so he had to be preserved afterwards. So that way he doesn't decay, right? So what was the process of that, like bringing him down from the mountain? Did he come down in a freezer?
No, he didn't come down in a freezer. Actually, they put everything in a plastic bag.
God.
And they ran to the Innsbruck helicopter. Fortunately for us, they call an archaeologist. And the archaeologist saw the body and saw the axe.
Hey!
this is just a replica, but, you know, he saw the axe, and when he saw the axe, said, "You know, oh my God, I can't believe it. This must be very old." At that time, he thought it was 4,000 years old, so he said, "Put it back on the freezer, please."
Now, the axe was unlike anything ever found before. It changed the timeline of prehistory and pushed the Copper Age back 1,000 years earlier.
Now, this early Neolithic body came with other things as well. It came with a backpack. It came with some goat and sheepskin trousers. It came with a dagger. It came with a bow, a quiver. And it was all in excellent condition because of the ice.
There's so much we don't know about Uzi. Retracing his steps, it's so easy to imagine him walking across these mountains 5,000 years ago.
Uzi is also famous for his tattoos. He has a series of small, black lines that are all over his body. Now, we've got this on his ankles and on his hands and on his back. And it turns out that they actually correlate with points of pain that Utsi would have had. So arthritis, joint pain, back pain. Was this the earliest form of acupuncture?
62 tattoos in his body, just line and cross. Mm. 59 line and just two crosses. Those tattoos, they could be therapeutic tattoos. They appear to be close to the spot where he was suffering of most arthritic problems, but they are not on top of those problems. They are always right beside, right above, right behind. Most of those tattoos, but not all of them, they match with the most important spot of the Chinese acupuncture. That's a good field for further studies.
Definitely. Yes. With the advancement of science, we're learning more and more about Utsi all the time. We found out that he's got O-positive blood. We found out that he has brown hair and that he had brown eyes. And we've even been able to have environmental archaeologists look at the cereals in his stomach, the last meal he ate before he died.
But one of the real mysteries is why Utsi died. Alone in the snow, high up in the mountains, did he get lost? Was it hypothermia? Or was it something far more sinister? Well, there's a fairly big clue.
One of the most interesting things about Utsi is that he was found with an arrow lodged underneath his shoulder. And that would have nicked a major artery, causing him to lose lots and lots of blood, eventually causing him to die. Now, he would have just been walking on the mountain, just like I am now, and somebody would have spotted him, thought he was a threat, and fired. So we know that there was a murder that happened, but we don't know who did it. So it's quite an interesting little whodunit.
We'll never know, of course, who fired that arrow. We'll never even know Utsi's real name. But the circumstances of his death have taught us so much about what life was like here thousands of years ago.
You can now go see Utsi's body at the South Tyrol Archaeology Museum in Bolzano. He's housed inside of a large freezer, so that way it stops his body from deteriorating. And if you feel extra bold, you can go up a mountain and actually go to the spot where his body was found.
It is so remarkable having a frozen body. So everything is intact and in such good condition. It's so much more like a kind of forensic investigation of a modern body rather than an archaeological project. Not only do we know so much about him, but we know that he had obviously travelled a lot before he met his death. And it emphasises how much travel would have been going on during whatever it is we call this. I mean, are we going to call it late Neolithic? Are we going to call it Copper Age? You have to acknowledge the fact that he's got that copper axe. I mean, it's just the most extraordinary thing, isn't it?
And the murder element of it as well is so exciting. There's so much to this story. Giselle is with us now, by the way, on the podcast in front of a very attractive brick wall for reasons that will become clear, actually. We will explain exactly where Giselle is and why she's there in a moment. Hi, Giselle.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Giselle. What is there left to learn about Utsi? I mean, he was discovered a few decades ago, and presumably people are still working on him with new techniques and so on.
Absolutely. There's new techniques that are coming out all the time that people are using. So XRF, which we've used at Time Team before, is a type of way to understand metal. And so the copper axe and other bits that he's got, we can start to understand those more, take deeper looks into maybe where the stone from the stone dagger, where that's come from, things like that, and start to get a better idea of how nomadic he really was.
And how do you think the work that they're doing with Utsi advances our understanding of the preservation of organic material? Because we've seen a lot of the shots from the lab there with them spraying the body and doing all this work to try and keep it frozen and preserved.
Well, I suppose nobody's ever had a body like this before. So we're starting to get kind of a long-term science project out of it and kind of understand what will happen 20 years down the line with the fridge freezer sort of situation that he's in, and see how much preservation can change, or, you know, do we need to change that and make a better fridge freezer for him to be in? How is he decomposing while in that situation? So it's quite interesting. There's a lot more projects that come out of it than people realise, I think.
So, Giselle, tell us where you are at the moment and what you're up to.
So I'm in Portsmouth. I've been a bit nomadic myself. I'm in Portsmouth digging with Operation Nightingale, and we are working with some veterans, but also training some Royal Military Police who are learning about archaeology and about human remains.
Just remind people who maybe aren't familiar with Operation Nightingale, what is it and how is it helping service and former service personnel?
So Operation Nightingale, it's an initiative by the Ministry of Defence. It's a project to help people through the media of archaeology, help them recover from PTSD, anxiety, any kind of trauma. Everyone can take part. A very worthwhile program to be a part of. And it's wonderful to see the changes that people can have happen.
I'm really agog to hear what you might have found down in Portsmouth, but I know you might not be able to tell us everything. So what have you found that you can tell us about?
Well, we've been going back to this site year after year. And the reason we're at this specific site in Portsmouth is because there's coastal erosion. And we've got burials that are in this island. And as it erodes, we're actually kind of just rescuing the bones as they come out and trying to get as much of the skeletons out as we can. So it's an old burial ground. And it's really interesting because we're actually digging them horizontally. So we start with the feet. We move up to the pelvis and we move up to the head in the end. And the further into the cliff we go, into the beach, the further we get towards the head. So we kind of, I've never ever gotten to dig something like that in that way. So it's a really cool site just for that alone.
Now, Giselle, before we let you go, I need to talk to you about Little Boy Blue. If you've been on our YouTube channel recently, you will have seen, hopefully, the trailer for something that we have coming up very, very soon, all to do with a B-17 bomber. I know, Helen, as well, you're very much involved in this too. So can you explain what this is all about and the fascinating film that it's coming out very soon?
Helen and I both were at a B-17 dig that was in the east of England, and we got to work with Operation Nightingale yet again, as well as Cotswold Archaeology and the DPAA, and we were looking for bits of plane, really. So it's quite a cool dig. It's a different way to dig yet again, and it'll be really interesting to see what we found.
Yes, the DPAA, Martin, it's the Department of the American government that's charged with, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Giselle, but they're the people that go out and make sure that no one's left behind. They try to find missing servicemen and if not bring them back, at least find out what happened. And this project's been really close to my heart because it's very close to my house. So I found myself talking to people who remember seeing it as children. I know them, you know, or I know their friends of friends. And it brings it really home that this happened right over the skies where I live now.
Yeah, it's really special. And being an American Hungarian, I have a big connection to the American side, and getting to work with American servicemen and work with people who are experts in planes and crashes. And you get to actually learn about different parts of the plane, what we can find and what we can learn about the people who are still in the ground and hopefully recover them.
And some of the stories are just extraordinary. I mean, it's really going to be worth watching when it finally comes out.
Well, if you haven't seen it already, make sure you check out the trailer, which is available to watch on YouTube right now. And keep your eyes peeled because the full feature-length time team on that B-17 excavation will be out very soon.
Thanks so much, Giselle, for making the space in your schedule to talk to us. I know you must be incredibly busy at the moment.
Yeah, probably go back to some barrels in a bit here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's lovely to catch up with you.
Thanks, everyone.
Now, the Council of British Archaeology's Festival of Archaeology is underway, with loads of events happening right across the country. There's all sorts of things going on, and Time Team's Derek Pittman and Lawrence Shaw are in Northern Ireland and soaking up the atmosphere.
Thanks, Helen. Lawrence and I are at the opening of the Festival of Archaeology, and this year we've got our Career in Ruins podcast hats on, and we're recording a podcast of this very event. We've been invited up here by the CBA to have a look at everything that's going on, and we wanted to share a taste of that, and indeed a sound of that, with you guys. Come this way.
Down here, we've got Northern Archaeological Consultancy, who've brought a brilliant collection of artifacts, starting with some of the earliest flintwork in the area, through some beautiful ceramics, right the way up to some much more modern stuff, including this fantastic collection of weaponry down the end here, which they've not let me have a go on yet for some reason. I'm not sure why. Next to them here at this stand, we've got someone making pots, some beautiful examples of recreated pottery here. And if you want to come and have a go at potting, all of the kit is here. We even have a flint napper in residence. Now, I was lucky earlier, I got to have a go at flint napping. It is one of the most fun things you can do archaeologically, and you get a real sense of the difficulty and the complexity that people in the past had to go through to make some of the really ornate flint artifacts that they would have used. But we're here for the festival, and of course the best person to ask about that is Neil Redfern, Executive Director of the CBA. Neil, tell us all about this year's Festival of Archaeology.
We've got 16 days, as usual, of just the most amazing opportunities to get involved in archaeology all across the UK. So we're starting this year with a weekend in Belfast. So we're on the side of Divis Mountain, which is looking completely different from where we were first thing this morning, where we had a deep mist set right down. That's cleared and it's actually looking really gorgeous. Our main closing event is going to be in Bradford this year to help Bradford celebrate their being capital of culture, which is fantastic. And on Monday, I start off on my grand tour of festival activities. So I'm actually heading down to the Dorset, Somerset, Devon area this year. And I pretty much got two events every day that I'm going to be visiting. So really, really lots of stuff going on. But our theme this year is actually archaeology and well-being. You know, whether it's mental health or physical health, and you know, the amazing role archaeology can play in that. You know, again, partly sometimes it's just being outside and being active. But it can go a lot deeper to actually just having conversations about, you know, our role in the world today and where we sit, using that lens of archaeology to explore connections through deep time.
Thank you, Neil. And I think there's no better place to think about the sense of well-being and good health you get in archaeology and heritage than when you're stood in a landscape like this. So watch out for future Career in Ruins episodes where we'll be covering and doing a deep dive into the whole event, and just listen out for more.
Oh, thank you very, very much, chaps. Good to see you. You'll be able to hear more about what Derek and Lawrence are getting up to in a future edition of the podcast. And the Festival of Archaeology, by the way, runs until the 3rd of August. There's details of events happening near you in the UK available online. And later on, you will be hearing from Danny Wooden with Time Team News. And she's been at Corfe Castle as well, which has also been involved with the festival.
Now to some really shocking news. A few months ago on the podcast, we were at Flag Fen in Cambridgeshire. It's the site of a prehistoric wooden causeway and an artificial island that was discovered by Time Team's Francis Pryor back in the 1980s. And as part of our visit there, we showed you a replica Iron Age roundhouse that the team have painstakingly built over the years to research construction methods and to give visitors a sense of what life on the fens might have been like.
Yeah, Francis took me into one of the roundhouses and I witnessed another one under construction. Loads of volunteers who are using traditional wattle and daub techniques to make the walls, special type of thatching as well, for example, used to make the roof. It was really interesting.
Yes, well, news reached us a few days ago that one of those roundhouses has been almost completely destroyed in a fire, which the fire service say they believe was started deliberately. Now, you can see on the pictures that the whole of the roof has gone, and I understand that that's, you know, that thatch is always a danger point. And although the fire service arrived very promptly, and we can see that there are some bits that aren't burnt down, but I don't think it's going to be salvageable. I think that's the whole thing that's gone and is going to have to be rebuilt. And it was such a lovely building, you know, it had a lot of ornamental detail that sometimes, you know, reconstructions don't always put that ornamental detail in, because if you're using the evidence just below ground, you don't really know what all those details looked like. It was such a pretty building, you know, and those buildings are great communal spaces as well. It was used for school visits, and really if instead of just hearing about a place, you can actually feel it, actually experience it, actually stand in that space. It can be so, so inspiring and so immersive. And that's what Flag Fen has lost.
It's such a shame, isn't it? They are trying to raise money in order to restore what they've lost. They're also asking for people's time. And so I would say that if you do have a moment to spare and you live sort of in and around the Peterborough area, do get in contact with Flag Fen. And if you can spare a few pounds, few pennies, few dollars that you want to throw in the direction of Flag Fen, do just head to their website. It's flagfen.org.uk and you'll find details there of how you can donate.
Yes, and I think one of the things we should say is that we can get some comfort from the fact that a burnt roundhouse was not uncommon in the past. Iron Age roundhouses burnt down all the time, and we'll be able to get information and knowledge from that. And there was a similar attack at the reconstructed Anglo-Saxon village of West Stowe many years ago now, and it ended up being actually really useful to compare the modern burnt down structure, where we know how it had burnt down, with the two houses that had burnt down in the Anglo-Saxon period. And there was actually a full excavation. I don't know whether Flag Fen are planning an excavation of this. And it does feel a bit strange to be excavating something that you remember standing only a few weeks ago. But in the end, it was really comforting at West Stowe that we'd gained something out of that disaster.
Now, we talk a lot on this podcast about new technology and how it's helping archaeologists do their work. But now, though, one archaeology student has been using a video game to give people a bit of an idea of the skills that you might need to be an archaeologist yourself.
Yes, Louise Bedford has created No Stone Left Unturned. It's set in a Wiltshire village in 1938, and you get to explore a real archaeological site to uncover its secrets.
That's right, and Louise is here with us now. Louise, great to have you, and I've got the game here in front of me, No Stone Left Unturned. So what I thought I'd do is I thought I'd play it as we chat. Tell me a little bit about this game and how you came up with the idea for it.
Yes, so for my archaeology dissertation, I know I wanted to do something a little bit different, and I've never made a game before. But I'd done an archaeo gaming module and just thought it'd be a great idea to try and incorporate this. And I started working with the Avebury Papers Project, who are digitising all this amazing stuff from the archive at Avebury. I thought I could make it into sort of a cosy little game for people to play.
Is that you bobbing up and down, Martin?
That's me bobbing up and down there, yes. Right, so here we go. So I'll start going around here. I'll start talking to this. Who's this chap then here?
So this is Alexander Keeler, who was the head of the excavations at Avebury in the 1930s.
I really wondered why you'd chosen such an old excavation such a long time ago. I mean, I know Avebury is very iconic, but 1938, you know, why did you choose that project?
So I'm with the Avebury Papers Project, which is a four-year project to sort of digitise Avebury's Neolithic origins. And because of the outbreak of World War II, a lot of the excavations at Avebury went unpublished. So this is sort of the first time we're seeing some of this amazing material coming out. And I just wanted to work with that to have this sort of charm and bring these stories back to life that might have been forgotten about.
And we can actually see, I mean, I'm coming across these pictures here now, aren't I? So these are the real pictures of the excavation. And so you're able to use this then as a way to teach people about this dig, aren't you? How much about it have you learnt yourself then as a result of coming up with this game?
I've honestly learnt so much. I did not know too much about Avebury. I knew it was absolutely iconic. It's one of the most important Neolithic sites in Europe. But coming to it and getting to recreate every single one of these stones by hand and landscape just gave me a whole new sort of perspective. And I think it's where sort of archaeologists come into things as creative makers, can just give us some much more amazing insights.
It's one of those things that you learn about when you find out about museums, that people do learn better when they're doing something, when they're using their hands or they've got a task to do, so that you'll be more likely to read text if you are turning over, say, a flip board with different bits of text on it. Is that one of the reasons why games are so good for learning about archaeology?
Yeah, I think so. It's sort of, you know, you get in more of an experience to make sort of an emotional connection with a site and material. And if you make that emotional connection you're probably going to remember it more and feel much more connected to it than
Absolutely.
If you've not.
Yes.
And Louise, how long did it take you to do this?
It took quite a while. So alongside making the game, I was also trying to document the process on social media to try and attract a younger demographic to archaeology. It took a very, very long time. Each stone sort of took up to 45 minutes to an hour to draw. And I think there's 42 stones in the game in total, just to give you some sort of perspective.
It's such a good idea. I think it's so wonderful. And it does, as you say, and here I am, you know, as my little avatar here. I'm walking around, I'm learning about this stuff, but I'm also playing the game and having fun. And I think if I was probably concentrating even more, Louise, I'd be able to, progress through this and find out even more. What's the eventual aim of this game, by the way, Louise? Like, what am I sort of... I'm just sort of having fun walking around reading the signs at the moment, but am I sort of working towards trying to do something here?
So once you've read and collected everything and you've got all of the figures, the numbers at the bottom corner collected... you can go back up to Alexander Keeler and he'll hire you to work on the excavation, and that's when the game sort of ends.
So where are you going with this kind of work next, Louise? I mean, I'm really impressed at all the noises, not just the music, but the horse snorting and all sorts of things, and the way that you've embedded things like that. That's an amazing picture of an Avebury stone within this retro 1980s game landscape. You must have learnt so many skills that most archaeologists don't have. Are you going to try making some more games?
It was definitely a massive learning curve, one that I have absolutely enjoyed. So I'm actually starting a master's in September in digital heritage. I'm not sure where I'm going to go with this, but I hope this isn't the end of No Stone Left Unturned. I'd love to add more to it, change it up a bit. I've got ideas for other games, but I'm hoping that I can somehow get there in my career. So yeah, definitely watch this space.
Oh, well, very best of luck with it, Louise. I'm just going to go listen to this, Helen, right? Listen to this. The sheep make noises.
This is a lot of people's favourite.
Oh, without a doubt. It is so good. There we are. And I'm learning so much, and I'm getting to read so much as well and learn about this site. Louise, it's a fantastic idea, brilliantly executed. If you're not getting a first for that, I don't know what you need to do. You did. Good.
I did.
Good. I'm very, very pleased to hear it. Congratulations with it.
Thank you. Well, here's to
the next one. Come on. Mm. And we need more of this.
Definitely agree.
Now let's catch up with the latest from the world of archaeology. And here's Danny with Time Team News.
Thanks, Helen. Well, first off this month, we're up north to Manchester for news of the discovery of a Roman road which has been discovered in the city centre. The Roman road was discovered whilst an excavation was being carried out on Liverpool Road in the Castlefield area, and it was only 40 centimetres under modern street levels. So just amazing to think how many people must have walked over it without realising that that road was just underneath their feet. There are several layers and repairs to the road that suggest that it's been in use for some time, and there are finds of glassware, animal bone and locally made and imported pottery, including a lovely bit of decorated Samian ware that still looks as wonderful today as it did 2,000 years ago. The finds excavated by the Archaeological and Built Heritage team at Civic date from the 1st to the 3rd century AD. The discovery of the Roman road is being hailed as one of the most significant archaeological discoveries in Manchester for the past 20 years, and it's hoped that the artefacts will go on display in the city once they've been analysed. Now we're going even further up north to Carnoustie in Scotland for news of the largest timber haul discovered in Scotland dating to the Neolithic period. It's about 6,000 years old, and that makes it about 1,000 years earlier than Stonehenge. Angus Council commissioned Gard Archaeology to excavate the site when two football pitches were being built for the local school. The Neolithic Hall was 35 metres long and 9 metres wide. It was built of oak, timber and wattle and daub walls. The team discovered fragments of deliberately deposited stone tools that had been made from rocks such as pitchstone from Arran and smoky quartz from the highlands, which had been brought some considerable distance to the hall. It suggested that the halls might have acted as a focal point for some of the first farmers to settle in the area, providing a space for celebrations and bringing people together from a wider area. And finally, this month is the Council for British Archaeology's Festival of Archaeology, and last weekend I was at Corfe Castle for the Time Team weekend. On the Friday night, we had a special community watch-along and we screened the Secrets of the Witch Farm episode, which we filmed back in 2023 at Corfe Castle. And it was screened in the Geodome within the Outer Bailey of Corfe Castle. It was, what an amazing atmosphere, almost like a festival. And then on the Saturday and the Sunday during the day at Corfe Castle, we had a range of archaeological activities happening within the Geodome. We had Naomi Supol with her flotation tank. We had Penny and other Time Team crew members helping with other archaeological activities. Emily Bolton, Time Team director, gave a talk behind the scenes of Time Team. So many activities happening, it was great. Corfe Castle has got such a rich history, but it was fantastic to see it being given an extra dimension with the Time Team Geodome. A big hello to all our visitors and our Time Team Patreons that we met over the weekend. Now, if you're based in Britain, there are lots of activities happening as part of the Festival of Archaeology right up until August the 3rd. So check out the Council for British Archaeology's website because I'm sure there will be something happening in your area. Well, that's all from me for now. Have a fantastic Festival of Archaeology wherever you are. I look forward to seeing you next time.
Oh, thank you, Danny, and we'll see you next month.
Okay, well, it's time for your questions now that you've submitted on Patreon.
And we've had loads of them this time. Thank you so much for getting in touch. If you want to do that, patreon.com/timeteamofficial. This one comes from Dave Houseman, who says, "Hello, Helen. What got you interested in archaeology? When you were a little girl, did digging for interesting things appeal to you? Or did something later on flip the switch?" What's the answer to this one then, Helen?
Well, that's a really good question. It wasn't that I was interested right from my childhood. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I had no idea that it just never occurred to me. I went off and did a youth training scheme, a government scheme, which trained me as a secretary. And I became an office junior in an architect's office in Bath. And I went to Bath Public Library pretty much every lunchtime to change the book that I was reading that afternoon because there wasn't that much work to do. I was interested in the past, you know, and I was reading my way through a shelf of royal biographies. So I know a ridiculous amount about Georgian kings and that kind of thing from that. And I got to the end of the shelf. It probably got to Victoria and that was the end of the shelf. And the shelf below was about archaeology. And I started reading through this and I thought, you can actually do this. This is done by real people who are paid for it. I could become an archaeologist. How? And so I started talking to people and I discovered that I had a friend who had a friend who was an archaeologist. And so I wrote him a letter, as you did in those days. And I said, I would like to become an archaeologist. How do you do it? And he told me that I would have to go to university and that I needed to have some kind of job. And that's really how I discovered it. It wasn't that I'd always wanted to be one. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I literally discovered it through the public library. And I'm a very passionate advocate of the randomness of libraries, that you wander about and something catches your eye. And it's not something that can be replicated in any other way. I think the public library is king.
So many other people, though, by the way, and a lot of the maybe slightly younger archaeologists became archaeologists because of Time Team, which I think is really cool. And that has reminded me of something I did when I was a lot younger. What I think I might do, because it's quite a fun story, I might save it to our next podcast next week, and I will confess something that I don't think I've ever confessed to anyone, because I was so sort of embarrassed and ashamed of what I did when I was about 8. And I have Time Team to blame, I think, for it. So we will get to that in a bit, because we need to get on to our next question. Now, we get asked this. I think this is the thing we get asked more than anything else when people submit their questions on Patreon. And it's sort of summed up here by Lorna, who's got in touch via video. Hello, Lorna. What's your question?
I was wondering, what is that cross-shaped object behind your shoulder in your little podcast booth? It's very intriguing, and I was wondering what its history is and what it means to you.
Yep, Lorna isn't the only person who asks this, by the way, Helen. For example, here's Carolyn, who says, "Hi, Helen and Martin from Vancouver in British Columbia in Canada. Helen, what is the cruciform carved object hanging on the wall behind you that we can see above your left shoulder? Is there a story about it that you might share with us? So go on, what is that thing there behind you?"
Well, at its most simple, it is the only part of the original Sutton Hoo exhibition. It was taken down and it was going to be thrown away, and it was the only bit that was small enough to fit in our house, and so I saved it from the skip and I hung it up there. But what it is an image, it's a photograph stuck onto a plywood mount of the Wilton Cross. Now, the Wilton Cross was found in the 19th century on the Norfolk-Suffolk border. And although it's known as the Wilton Cross because it's thought to have been found in Hockwold cum Wilton, it's very uncertain because it was found so long ago. And it's in the British Museum, and we can put the link to the collections online, the British Museum collections online record, under this podcast, can't we? And people can go and have a look at it and find out all the details. It's a Roman coin, a 7th century Roman coin, so you could call it a Byzantine coin, of the Emperor Heraclius. And it's been put into a gold and garnet Anglo-Saxon mount, which is rather similar to some of the Sutton Hoo garnet jewellery. For me, it kind of sums up my academic life. My doctorate was on the use of Roman culture in Anglo-Saxon England, so almost like the first Renaissance. Because it's from Hockwold cum Wilton, that kind of area, it's on the border of the two counties that I've lived and worked in and studied the most. And that's why I love having it there. And I love the fact, you know, it's been there for ages, but ever since COVID and Zoom, I love the fact that it's behind me. And what I'm waiting for, really, is for somebody to ask, why is it upside down? Why the coin is upside down? Because if you look closely at it, you can see, even from here, I think if I point, you can see that there's a kind of triangle there that's got its apex down, and that's a set of steps on which a cross is put. Clearly the cross was the important thing to whoever was wearing it. But why it's upside down, why the cross isn't on the steps, rather the steps are above the cross, nobody quite knows. There is a little clue. If you go and look at the British Museum Collections online thing, there is a picture of the back, and that might give a clue, but I'll leave everybody to go and have a look at it and make up their own mind. Yes, so it's the Wilton Cross from Hockwold cum Wilton. It's a really delightful little object.
You slightly shattered the illusion that I had as well by telling me that it's a photograph on some plywood, and that it's sort of a blown up version of it as well, and that it's sort of maybe kind of upside down sort of thing. But now you know, and hopefully that will stop the hundreds of people getting in touch asking what it is. Thank you so much, though, if you have got in touch with questions. On our podcast next week, by the way, we have loads more of your Patreon questions. So if you have asked one and you haven't heard the answer to it yet, it could be that we're saving it until next week. Speaking of Patreon, by the way, whilst we are here, a great place to go for so much more from Time Team. And we have a new offer coming out very, very soon on our annual Patreon membership. So do keep your eyes peeled for that, because it is well worth considering. And some of the things that you might be able to enjoy, by the way, coming very soon for that annual membership, we've got new masterclasses, including some metal detecting masterclasses. We have Bear taking you through how he captures some of the objects and the artifacts that we deal with. Stuart Ainsworth as well takes you through the lumps and the bumps that he analyzes. We also have special conversations with our experts. There's Martin Carver talking about the story of his time at Sutton Hoo. And speaking of Sutton Hoo, there's Meg talking to a shipwright at the Sutton Hoo Ships Company, that reconstruction project. There's loads more besides. Get yourself onto Patreon. There's a whole community, and you're supporting all of the work and the archaeological digs that we do as part of Time Team. Patreon.com/Time Team Official.
And that's it from Martin and me on this latest edition of the Time Team podcast. Thanks so much for watching, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.